It's the ultimate business trip, flying in Emirates First Class. With your own fully enclosed private suite, you can order from an extensive international menu along with premium drinks. There's even a bar and an exclusive shower spa on the Emirates A380. Along with chauffeur-driven airport transfers and the Emirates Lounge, it's a better way to do business. Book now on Emirates.com.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes-Cullerton. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Now, coming up on today's show, what's really going on with crypto and is it crunch time? Also, the economics of the happiest place on earth. We look at how Disney World theme parks operate, plus one of the best economics books I've ever read called A Little History of Economics. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, we're going to be talking about crypto shortly in the show and its respective volatility. So I thought what would be worthwhile starting off today with is an explainer about what a stable coin is, and particularly how that's different to traditional cryptocurrency. So a stable coin is a type of cryptocurrency designed to maintain a stable value. Now, it's usually pegged to a stable asset like the US dollar, and that might be done by holding reserves or using algorithms to manage supply and demand. Have you spotted how often I've used the word stable so far? Now, the biggest one is called Tether. So by name and nature, the design of a stable coin is what makes it less volatile than Bitcoin or Ethereum. So now, when you're listening to conversations about this, you'll know the difference. Now, as we turn to the topsy-turvy world of cryptocurrency, where Bitcoin's peak-to-trough price decline is around about 40-odd percent at this point, we're going to have a deep dive into what's really going on. I'm delighted to be joined now by Reuters' Hannah Long. Hannah, there are so many reasons that people are giving for this very steep decline. People are talking about the Clarity Act. People are talking about the impact of AI and the spending that is being had on AI in tech companies. People are talking about fear, uncertainty and doubt. What do you think is going on with Bitcoin at the moment, just as a litmus test of the cryptocurrency market in general?
Yeah, well, I think the reason why people are talking about so many different things is that there's not really one clear reason why the cryptocurrency market and Bitcoin are struggling so much. We really saw the market sell off last week after President Trump appointed a new Fed chair who analysts expect will lead to a tighter Fed balance sheet, which is generally negative for risk assets like cryptocurrency, and that's also why we've seen tech stocks sell off as well. And you also mentioned kind of concerns around an AI bubble that has also weighed on Bitcoin and crypto the last couple of months. There are also geopolitical concerns about Iran and also concerns about quantum computing and that advances in that could undermine the cryptography of Bitcoin and many other cryptocurrencies as well. So it's really a confluence of reasons that are leading to this moment where we see Bitcoin really struggling and very almost has lost half its value in a couple of months.
And I want to explore all of that with you. First off, let's start with the White House, because when Trump came into power for the second time, he said that he wanted the US to become the crypto capital of the world. And then we saw a massive price rise, and that was really sustained right throughout. At this point, all of the gains that anybody who bought Bitcoin have been wiped out since then. So if you had bought on the day of the election, you're now underwater. And so, absolutely, I completely get what you're saying about Kevin Marsh and the new Fed chair. But Trump is still in power. So is the market completely discounting the power he has now to influence the price of this?
Yeah, I think the market was really excited. As you said, you know, Trump made a lot of promises on the campaign trail, and you know, his regulators, once he assumed office last year, really took a lot of steps to, you know, unwind some of what the previous administration had done that the cryptocurrency industry had called harmful. But, you know, there is some stalled momentum right now. One of the cryptocurrency industry's marquee pieces of legislation that they wanted has kind of struggled to gain momentum amid kind of a lobbying fight between the banks and crypto. And it's really unclear if we're going to see that pass at all or this year, which is something that, you know, the industry really wanted at one point. And they've called this kind of existential to their future in the U.S. and that without it, we could see companies leave the U.S. and look elsewhere, go offshore. So that is definitely weighing on momentum and has kind of tampered a lot of the excitement that we saw around this time last year.
Well, speaking of things existential, if I wanted to buy cryptocurrency, of course I could buy Bitcoin, and we will talk about others. But alternatively, what I could do is I could buy shares, for example, in Coinbase, which is like a stock broker for cryptocurrency or stock exchange. And then, of course, there is Gemini. And that is not to be confused with Google's AI. That is the crypto exchange Gemini. Shares have fallen in that stock by 80% since September. Like, so is it that not just the cryptocurrency itself, but the whole infrastructure around it that investors are losing faith in?
Well, I think the cryptocurrency industry is really struggling right now, and there's a lot of things that are weighing on the momentum, as we've discussed. I think, you know, last year was a really big IPO window. You mentioned Gemini. They went public last year along with a bunch of other crypto companies and during what was a really favorable window for companies to go public. And Gemini had a really successful IPO, but you know, now very quickly that window has really closed and investors are really thinking twice about risk assets. And that includes crypto and therefore crypto companies. You know, people are wondering kind of how they can sustain momentum and for exchanges in particular, you mentioned Coinbase as well, if they can sustain trading volume, given that there is depressed interest in crypto right now. You know, people were really interested in trading crypto when its value was soaring last year, but there's questions about whether people will still be interested given, you know, the decline in value we've seen recently.
You know, if I was talking to you 2 weeks ago, Hannah, we might have made a simple extrapolation that what is not going into risk assets, including crypto, is going into gold.
Yeah.
However, I am not talking to you 2 weeks ago. I am talking to you today. And when we have seen the drop in the gold price and particularly the drop in the silver price, okay, fair enough. Particularly silver had gone parabolic. Sorry, I got my syllables mixed up there. So where is the money that is being liquidated out of crypto going, do you think? Is it a flight to quality? Is it going straight to cash? Is it staying put? Or is it waiting at the sidelines, ready to go back in when they feel the market turns?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think normally in other times we would see money going out of crypto and into something considered safer like gold. But as you mentioned, we're not seeing that right now. So I think it's hard to know, but I think it's fair to assume that some of this is going out into cash and money sitting on the sidelines, given that, you know, we're not really seeing inflows to anything else significantly at the moment. But it's one of those things we'll kind of have to wait and see. I mean, I don't think we know for sure how things are going to play out. And especially in retail trading, retail really bought up precious metals, gold and silver. And retail had also previously bought up crypto. So I think it's really unclear kind of where we're headed next here. And if retail traders, you know, might focus on something else.
Speaking of the traders, I've been listening to the commentary around Bitcoin from the perspective of those who are trading it, which is different to, you know, people who might be buying it as an asset, let's say. And first of all, there seems to be uniformity now that Bitcoin is in a bear market. And for those who may not be familiar with that term, that means that the momentum is to the downside. No surprise, given that it's almost down half, as you say. But it's interesting listening to the traders. They're saying this is worse than COVID. This is worse than the October the 10th liquidity crash. This is basically a black swan event, that the RSI indicator, which is the relative strength indicator, is worse on this than anything they've seen in the past 100 years. They're saying that it's oversold. Sometimes when you hear everybody saying the same thing, the opposite might be true. So how does that correlate to those who are looking at this from a macro geopolitical perspective, like you were mentioning earlier?
Interesting. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of different factors at play here. I think that, you know, sentiment, for one, is you know, really poor right now because, as you mentioned, the crypto industry has a lot of things going for it. They have a very friendly administration in the U.S., whereas, you know, in previous bear markets, they've been able to kind of look to a more, what they've deemed a more hostile administration, like the Biden administration, and kind of blame it on external factors. You know, when FTX collapsed, they were able to kind of say, like, you know, that was an anomaly and is, you know, not due to crypto. It's kind of outside forces. So that, I think, is why sentiment is so bad. But I think also, you know, it's really not certain kind of what the path forward looks like on kind of a more macro lens. It's the rate cut path for the Fed and other central banks is pretty uncertain right now. And so we have to wait to see how that plays out. And, you know, also, I think the market has really been kind of seesawing back and forth via Trump's trade policies as well. And, you know, the market saw a huge flash crash on October 10th when Trump announced new tariffs on China. And so there's kind of an expectation that, you know, something out of the blue could really happen to impact crypto prices even further. So that is something that people, you know, are perhaps taking into account right now.
Well, if there was a way to summarize your entire point there, I found on Kalshi that traders have begun making bets, basically, with their money on how low the price of Bitcoin could fall. And currently, based on that platform, they feel there's an 85% chance that it would fall below $60,000, which of course it did for a moment on Thursday. But to have a sustained fall down to there, it brings us into new territory. However, can I ask you to elaborate a bit more on a point that you brought up earlier on in our conversation, which is the decrease in the share prices of companies, particularly who are investing heavily in AI. So on Thursday, I believe, we saw that the decline in the price of Amazon, because they're planning to spend more than what investors expected. We saw around about a 20% decrease in the share price of Microsoft this week. How is the market joining the dots between the two? What has investment in AI got to do with the price of Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's a good question. And maybe it kind of sounds unrelated at first, but in general, you know, companies investing in AI and tech companies are considered riskier assets. AI is a really powerful technology, but it's still really uncertain how it's going to kind of change the way we work and we live. And so companies are spending quite a bit of money, like you mentioned, Microsoft and Amazon, and we still don't really kind of know how that's going to play out and whether the money they're spending is ultimately going to be worth it. And so for that reason, tech stocks are considered a riskier asset. They're a riskier bet, less of a sure thing than, for example, bonds, which, you know, pay out a kind of set percent of yield. And so risk assets tend to really struggle when there are headwinds, like macroeconomic headwinds, when, you know, we're looking at less spending potentially by the central bank, when we're looking at a slower pace of rate cuts than perhaps we might have thought earlier. And it also, risk assets don't like uncertainty. I think we saw the market really struggle again when, you know, we had a couple of weeks ago the Trump wanting to buy Greenland, and we saw another sell-off. So the uncertainty is really poor and weighs on risk assets like tech stocks and, of course, crypto, which is also a risk asset because it's not actually based on sort of any inherent value. And so therefore, it's probably on the riskier spectrum of risk assets.
So can I just bring it back to the fundamental technology that enables cryptocurrency to happen, namely blockchain? And I remember when I started learning about this first, as a technology now is distinct to anything else, and it was supposed to solve the problems of the world because, of course, it was immutable, which means you can't change any records in the past. It could potentially entirely replace accounting. It could decentralize transactions, so we didn't need a central bank anymore. And of course, this enabled the T plus one or the T plus three settlement periods for any transactions to be instead moving to instant instant exchanges of value. Where are we at now in the world with cryptocurrency? Like, does it still have the relevance as a technology in the future?
I think that's a question that a lot of people are asking right now. And I wouldn't be surprised if we're in a sustained bear market, if a lot of people kind of turn to talking about the technology. There's a lot of movement to what's called tokenize real world assets, or put a representation of something that's kind of more tangible, like a stock or gold, on the blockchain, so it can have those capabilities of trading instantly and 24/7, like you mentioned. But, you know, there's also questions right now that are really weighing on the crypto price as well, about quantum computing and how advances in that could undermine cryptography, which is crucial to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies as well. So, you know, I think it's very likely that in the next couple of months, if we see, you know, the prices remain depressed, that we'll see more people talk about using blockchain technology. And a lot of banks and financial institutions are exploring or testing how blockchain might be used to kind of settle instantly. But I think it's also worth noting that people are exploring how, you know, stocks and other assets can settle instantly without blockchain as well. And moving kind of more towards 24/7 trading, even without blockchain. So I think that's kind of the general direction of travel we're moving in overall. But it's kind of to be seen whether it's based via blockchain or something else.
And there are so many assumptions there to challenge within it, because a lot of those, whether it's down to settling or the speed at which money moves or the tangibility of what we can see, as well as, of course, the fundamental coding that goes into cryptography in its own right. There's lots and lots there for us to watch out for. So thank you indeed so much, Hannah Long from Reuters, joining me from New York. Very much appreciate your time today on Taking Stock.
Thank you for having me.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the economics of Disney World. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for my trivia this week, I was in a city which was host to the Winter Olympics in 2010. Greenpeace was founded there in 1971. And this city is home to the longest swimming pool in that respective country. And the length of that swimming pool is 137 metres. So where was I last week? I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, contrary to popular belief, Disney's business model is driven by theme parks and not movies. And this fact may go some way to explain why the media juggernaut is about to hand the reins of the company to Josh D'Amaro, a parks specialist who is being promoted from his current position as chairman of Disney's experiences division, and that's theme parks and cruise ships, to you and me, right up there to CEO. Now, joining me to unpack what is going on in Disney, and particularly from the experiences side, is Christian Silt, freelance journalist who specialises in covering the theme park industry and the leisure sector. First of all, Christian, you're very welcome to Taking Stock. And I noticed that experiences are now the company's biggest cash cow by far. They generate 56.9% of its $17.6 billion operating income and 38.3% of its $94.4 billion revenue last year. So how has the theme park business developed to such an extent over the years?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the theme park industry itself, which was, we could say, essentially was invented by Walt Disney back in, you know, in post-war America in the 50s with Disneyland in California. It's been around for obviously a long time. But in terms of generating the kind of numbers we see today, there's no question that the pandemic was actually key to that, ironically, because you had a situation post-pandemic when theme parks in the States in particular started to reopen again after lockdown, where you had a large number of potential guests who were really flush with a lot of furlough cash, a lot of money. And the ones that were inclined to travel were prepared to pay a premium to do so. So, and this isn't specifically restricted to Disney, but Disney being the world's biggest theme park operator in terms of attendance, really, they took advantage of this, capitalized on this trend, which is the fact that you had prices that were increased because people were prepared to pay a premium to travel. But then beyond that, you had a number of frills that were cut during the pandemic, perhaps for logistical reasons during the pandemic, but didn't return coincidentally after the pandemic receded. So in the States in particular, you had, for example, queue-cutting passes that enabled visitors to cut the lines to specific to attractions for free, and they were removed, and they became a paid-for service. And, you know, as I said, ostensibly, these sort of things, you had the buses from airports to from the airports to the parks and this sort of thing, and free wristbands that got access to hotel rooms and the like. And, you know, there was an aspect of the number of these kind of frills where you could say, well, there were touch points, and during the pandemic, that wasn't safe. But as I said, there, you know, a number of them just simply haven't returned afterwards, and it cut the costs and increased the profits. So you had that scenario where the operating income was going up to the levels that that they've reached today. And then also you had a situation at the same time where people were paying a premium to be there. And again, during the pandemic, it was very easy to say, well, look, what we're doing is we're managing the numbers in the parks. They were obviously capped at a much lower level than they are now that there is COVID is not a problem internationally for international travel. So, you know, Disney was able to say, and other operators, to be fair. But as I said, Disney being the biggest, they were capitalised on this more than their rivals. Disney was able to say, look, you've got a small number of people in the park, so it's a more premium experience. So the prices are going up. And hence you had this situation where the revenue started to increase. And of course, the interesting thing is that post-pandemic, the prices continue to increase. So hence they fit the levels they are that you just mentioned today.
I have been only to the Disney park in Florida. First time I was there, actually, I was 25 and I said, this is fabulous. I thought I was wasted on children because I was intrigued with the place. I really, really loved it. And indeed, the fast pass of skipping the queues and so on. I know exactly what you're talking about. And also, I was struck by all the quotes up around the area with some Disney quotes, one of them being it's fun to do the impossible. But another one was that Disney says he doesn't sell tickets to theme parks, he sells memories. I mean, it's an extraordinary brand for locking that in, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, no question about that. And I think there's the interesting part in my mind is that there's not one single factor that drives that. It's a heck of a lot of factors. Not least what Disney refers to as the Disney bubble. And this is particularly apparent in Florida, although to a slightly lesser extent at its other parks. But in Florida in particular, because it's the biggest Disney complex, indeed the biggest theme park complex in the world. You know, you've got four theme parks and two water parks. But then on top of that, you've got dozens of themed hotels. You've got a shopping and dining complex. There's actually a sports complex there. You know, it's essentially, it's a mini city. And I forget the exact stats, but it's in terms of the actual hectares and space, but it's comparable to, you know, many large cities, the overall space it sits on. And the important thing is that area, there are no rival theme park operators on that area. It's self-contained, it even to a degree has its own security services and, you know, governance to a degree.
And maybe what not everybody is familiar with is that Disney made that the entire region what it is today. I mean, I watched the Disney series that is on Emirates Airlines. I think that's where I saw it. And I was on a pretty long flight. And I know you're joining me from Dubai today. So from where your accent suggests you're from right to where you are, there's a fair distance between, and you could watch the whole series in it. But it's a documentary about the rise and rise of Disney, particularly in Orlando, where it originally was a swamp, and he bought up all the land and then said, right, I'm going to make this into what it is. But that's where it started. If we look at where we're at now, when DeMauro steps into the CEO role and he faces a valuation benchmark, Bob Iger, who was his, we'll say, is currently CEO, soon to be his predecessor, that would require lifting Disney's market cap more than fourfold to over $800 billion. Is it realistic, do you think, for a parks-led strategy to drive Disney towards that type of evaluation?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it would be incredibly difficult. And, you know, that valuation, the 800, is you know, that will be based on what the value of the company will be when he steps down. And the key question, that's tomorrow. And the key question is, we don't know when he'd step down. It could be, you know, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. But, and obviously there's inflation built into that. So, you know, because that's what it was the case with Iger. I mean, he joined in 2005 and obviously got essentially 20-year tenure, and it's gone up by, you know, multiple fold market valuation of Disney during that period. So, you know, if the same was to happen with DeMauro, he'd have to hit 800 billion to equal Iger's record. Now, it depends when he steps down, but I mean, realistically speaking, it's a huge, huge mountain to climb. Theme parks, obviously, he's the specialist there, and he's added approximately, you know, $10 billion in revenue to the theme park division. This is DeMauro since he's been in charge of it in the past 5 years, you know, so it's not inconceivable that he could have that kind of magic touch. But I mean, I think it's back to what we were saying, really, you know, what are the key facets that make the theme park industry so crucial to Disney's bottom line and in its overall business. And, you know, things like that Disney bubble where everything is on site and it's kind of like a fairy tale experience unlike any other. They're crucial to that because people will pay a premium for it. The difficulty is, how long are people prepared to continue to paying, you know, increasingly high sums for that, because the ticket prices just keep on going up, and that's a challenge for DeMauro.
And while that is the case, and you're right, it certainly is a challenge for it, in order to actually grow at that level, you are, and being, hemmed in by the capacity that's there. I want to go back to that figure I mentioned at the beginning. 56, well, let's say close enough to 60% of the operating income or profit comes from theme parks. So if you're going to continue to drive that, well, then do you need new locations? So close enough to where you are there in Dubai, across about 90 minutes away in Yas Island, they're currently building out Disney, which is planned to open between 2030 and 2033, I think. Apart from that, we've got Hong Kong, we've got Tokyo, we've Paris, we've California. Is the ambition big enough?
I think where it starts to get interesting is the fact that Abu Dhabi, for example, was chosen because there was a bit of a void here. You've got Paris, which is the closest to, or one of the closest Disney parks to here, and that's approximately 7 hours away by plane, 6-7 hours. Then in the other direction, that's going west, and then in the other direction going east, you've got Hong Kong and Shanghai, which are again about 6-7 hours from here. So there is a bit of a void here. Now, if you look, starting west to east, west with Disneyland in California on the west coast of the States, you have Disneyland, then, you know, going a few hours, 5 hours, approximately 6 hours across the States, you've got Florida. Then another 6 or 7 hours, you've got Paris. Another 7 hours, you've got Abu Dhabi. Another 7 hours, you've got Shanghai, Hong Kong. Then another few hours, you've got approximately 3 hours, you've got Tokyo. If you look at that, you've really crossed the globe. Obviously, going from Tokyo to California, it's another 7 or 8 hours or so. A bit more than that, I think. But so you're basically there. With Abu Dhabi, they really do cover all areas of the globe. Now, that's with what I would call Disney's mega parks. There's a new trend in the themed entertainment industry for what are known as location-based entertainment. If you think of a traditional Disney park, it's massive. It has to be out of town. You can't fit these things typically in town centres, city
that's
centres.
True.
They're huge. So that involves people coming out of a town or out of a city, out of the population area, to visit them outside the city. In contrast, location-based entertainment centres are smaller venues that are typically found closer to a city centre. Now, Netflix is starting to launch this with what they call Netflix House, which are like essentially they're all under one roof themed areas, themed to Netflix shows. Universal Studios, Disney's main rival, is launching these with horror themed attractions in American cities as well. And there's talk of them building one in India. And I think the benefit with these is smaller venues under one roof, you know, in like a cavernous hangar type building. You can, they're obviously easier to fit into city centre type locations, so closer to the population, so easier for people to visit. They're quicker to get up because they're smaller than a mega park, and then, you know, therefore the price of entry can be cheaper. Now, this is an emerging trend. Universal is doing it. Netflix is doing it. If these are successful and they start to plug even smaller gaps around the world, then I think Disney's going to perhaps have to go in that direction. So you could see other markets pop up for Disney parks, smaller Disney parks. It's typically not gone down that direction. There were a few attempts over the past 20, 30 years to do smaller Disney, let's say, attractions that were either pop-ups or, you know, under one roof, but they've not been a widespread success. But I think if Netflix and Universal keep this aggressive rollout of those kind of parks, then Disney may have to do that and plug the smaller gaps that I was talking about. Because at the minute, the mega parks are going to, with the opening of Abu Dhabi, they're just going to cover all the key areas, really all the key catchment areas of the globe.
And while we focused a fair bit there on the price and the price in comparison to its competitors, of course, the tactics matter as well. And I remember when I went there, as I say, that first time when I was 25, I think it was about $85 at the day, for the day. And if I ate or drank nothing else, I didn't have to spend another dollar if I didn't want to. There was ample opportunity if I did now, however. And when we look at, say, in-park retail design tactics like exit through gift shop layouts and, you know, that driving that per capita guest spend, do you see the strategy potentially changing from getting the upfront investment being higher, being, when I say upfront investment, I mean the ticket price, and then trying to grow the margin or grow the amount that it's receiving per customer, that strategy might shift in response to that competitive environment?
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting point because to my mind, and, you know, I'm a... There are two ways of looking at it, let's say. And to my mind, I would prefer a strategy, but I'm biased, obviously. I prefer a strategy where the ticket price is essentially free and you have to pay even more for food and beverage and merchandise because, you know, you could just stroll in when you have, you know, you have the time. But Disney, to be, you know, to be completely clear, Disney pursues the exact opposite model, unfortunately.
Well, do you know what, Christian? It sounds like what you want is Disney Springs as distinct to going into Disney World because that's available to you there. Thank you very much indeed for sharing that around the world global view of not just the company and its past, but also where it's headed in its future. Christian Sill, freelance journalist who specialises in covering the theme park industry and leisure sector.
Thanks very much.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk, and up next, a little history of economics. Now, my next guest is an author I've been excited to talk to for some time. Niall Kishtaney believes the history of economic thinking and of real economic struggles can tell us a lot about our current situation. And if there was ever a time to be talking about that, of course it is right now. He wrote a book called A Little History of Economics. My friend Monica gave it to me a while ago and I settled into this over Christmas and I was gripped from cover to cover. So Niall, you're really welcome to Taking Stock. You make a striking statement at the very beginning when you say you might not think of you and your family as being especially rich, but to many people around the world, spending money on a book and being able to read it would seem as likely as a trip to the moon. Now, that was one of your opening statements. Can you give us some insight into why you think that, please?
I mean, I guess it's what I was doing there was trying to paint a broad picture of why people think that economics is important, right? It's not just when you say the word economics to people, sometimes they think, oh, you know, it's stock markets and finance and all that sort of stuff. But actually, it's about something much more basic, which is these huge questions of, you know, how do people live decent lives where they have enough food and medicine and clothes to survive and to thrive. And that actually, of course, we live in a world of massive inequality where there are people in poor countries that don't have the basics as we do in richer countries. So it's these, you know, these very, very basic questions of human well-being, really, that I think where economics starts from. And taking that historical approach, you know, going back to those earlier thinkers like Adam Smith and you know, Karl Marx and so on, that's what they were interested in, those big kind of questions of human well-being. And so we shouldn't sort of lose sight of that in some of these more very sort of sophisticated mathematical kinds of economics that we study today, that those basic questions are really what should be driving it all.
Niall, I co-wrote the economics textbook for the Leaving Cert here in Ireland three times over the past around about 18 years. And in the first two, the economists were on the syllabus. And we were always seeking to think about how we could think of ways to make it exciting for them, of the characters you mentioned, like Adam Smith, Karl Marx, and many others besides. And the way in which you do it is you tell stories that are grounded in everyday life, which is one of the reasons that I found it so enjoyable to read. But You talk about really big developments in economics, ranging from when households moved from assuming they needed to grow their own food to the first forms of commerce, the whole idea of lending money, because of course that had to be drawn up as an idea first, the impact of the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, when you look back over the 10,000 years that you condense down into the book, I do wonder, we think we're living in a world of constant change. Didn't previous generations, like years and years and years ago, have much bigger changes like the light bulb, the Industrial Revolution, the ability to buy and sell things?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I think history is so, it's so interesting to look at economics from that historical perspective. Often economics isn't looked at from a very historical perspective, you know, going back to those mathematical models that you often learn when you're at college. But actually looking at it through that historical lens allows you to see how economics has changed through these, you know, as you say, huge epoch-making changes, going from agriculture to industry and so on, and through to the sort of later industrial revolutions that we had in the 20th century. And I think it's really important to sort of connect what economists are doing with those historical shifts.
And can I jump to something that, from my research around your other writing, you look at a lot, which is utopia. How could we get to a world where everything's great? And I'm going to go to the chapter where you spoke about Charles Fourier, and I think I'm saying his name correctly there. He proposed an idea in the early 1800s of a phylanstery, which I also think I'm pronouncing correctly, but I'm not sure. So he said this would be a rectangular building with workshops, libraries and an opera house. It would be a place where you could pursue your passion to the full and it would be carefully organised. But instead of working a boring job, you could do whatever you wanted and people would get a share of the profits that the phylanstery earned. The only problem was nobody wanted to give Fourier the money to set this up. Yeah. So with that in mind as the pre-context, is there any economic model you see that could actually bring us to a utopian world?
That was quite a cheeky chapter in a way, because
there was a few of them.
Yeah, absolutely. You wouldn't normally get that in a history of economics, but I think that, you know, I wanted to think about, you know, how have thinkers that maybe, you know, they Fourier is probably not what you would call a strict, he's definitely not a strict textbook economist, but how people have thought about, you know, alternatives and other kinds of economic systems. I'm certainly not going to give you a recipe for a perfect economic society, but I think it's important to, I guess the reason why those guys are really interesting to look at is that they are thinking beyond that. Economics has become quite narrow in the way that it sees human flourishing, right? So it often sees it in terms of material goods, in terms of things like GDP. It thinks of people as, certainly the traditional neoclassical economics, as these sort of rational agents who are sort of constantly calculating and so on. So I think it's important to sort of broaden economics out from that quite narrow way of thinking about human well-being and even how humans behave and what drives them. And so people like, you know, Fourier and those sort of utopians are, I suppose that's why I put them in there, thinking about those broader conceptions of what are the different things that make up a good life. A lot of economics hasn't been very good at doing that.
Well, and the one thing that comes through the book over and over again is how we can learn from economic history and apply it to today. In many ways, people would attribute terms like work-life balance to something that we might have talked about in the past 20 years. And yet, he was talking about this back in the 1800s. Is it the fact that you see, of all the economic history that you've studied, it repeating itself over and over? And even the thinking that we think might be new isn't?
Yes, I think that's a reason to study things in historical context. I mean, one example of that would be something like technology. So one of the big things that people are worrying about, it does feed into sort of work-life balance, things like AI and computer, new computer technology and so on, and people getting, you know, there's a lot of anxiety about it, of course. It's a new technology. It has a lot of promise and a lot of opportunities, but also it brings up anxiety and concern. But of course, we've had technological waves through many centuries, So going back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier, moving from the epoch of agriculture to industry, and then the various industrial revolutions that happened after that, these were waves of technology as well. And quite some very similar sort of effects were going on, you know, in the early 19th century, for example, in the early part of the Industrial Revolution, to what's happening now with AI. So, yeah, I think history kind of rhymes, doesn't it? You know, new patterns do kind of repeat themselves or echo in interesting ways. So that's why I think it's important to look at economics in that historical context.
Well, in each one of those, you also point out that there was winners and losers. And usually the losers in an economic concept were those who didn't adapt. And on several occasions, and you even did it in the very first answer that you gave to me in this interview, and that is, you on several occasions, you point towards inequality. But I felt you absolutely went straight for it in chapter 39 when you drew on the historical law of capitalism, which is Thomas Piketty's point about R greater than G. So let me just explain this to listeners first, and then I'd like to get your take on it. The whole idea here is that if one can invest their money, and the implication here is that they have it to invest in the first place, but if one can invest their money and get a return that's higher than wage growth, one's wealth can grow faster than the average income. And therein, am I right then, Niall, lies the reason we have a K-shaped economy today, where we're seeing two different factions of society moving in different directions in terms of how much money they're earning.
Yeah, so I mean, so he kind of uses that as a kind of stylized fact, that, you know, when you have that R, so that return on wealth growing really much faster than growth, growth being where wages are paid out of, that you get this concentration of wealth, and that particularly since the sort of 1970s. So there's nothing necessarily universal about that. It shifts according to kind of policy interventions and how we decide to run the economy. But particularly since the 1970s, that gap between R and G got bigger. Mm-hmm. So growth, obviously since the 1970s, growth has not been as strong as it was in the sort of first decades after the Second World War, and also those returns on wealth were getting higher. And so since the 1970s, there's been this pattern of increasing inequality. But I think what Piketty's point is there is that there's nothing kind of preordained about that. That doesn't have to be a kind of universal thing. It's to do with our the choices that we make as societies. There are interventions that you could think of that would actually squeeze that gap, make R closer to G again, and create a more equal dynamic, a more equal kind of economy.
Despite the fact that that chapter was about 5 pages long, there was so much woven into it about, well, who should intervene? And one can argue that you can say that it's about choices that you have, but if there's no more money left at the end of the month, how can somebody get access to a rate of return? There was so much there that it was really interesting the way in which you put it, but then you touched on it at many, I felt you were leading up to that chapter at that stage. Now, as you can imagine, I am definitely going to have to ask you about the missing women chapter. And it ties back to something you also said earlier about how economics tends to be quite narrow in terms of looking at things like GDP and numbers. And of course, a number is something that you can count, Niall. So I liked the way you critiqued a fundamental flaw in economics, one in which I share a strong view about, and that is, if something isn't counted, well, then it doesn't count in the lens of the science. So you said calculations by the United Nations show that unpaid work could be the equivalent of 70% of the world's economic production. Most of that unpaid work is done by women. And therefore, women have often been written out of economic thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so that very sort of dramatic finding by Amartya Sen, the great economist who sort of looked, you know, if everyone was getting access to resources without sort of biases, I mean, there should be more women in the world than men, right? Because they live longer. Mm-hmm. There should be slightly, but in many countries there weren't. There were actually a deficit of women. Looking at the data, and that's a very sort of stark demonstration of women being overlooked in certain kinds of economic systems, as you said, the unpaid work, and not getting access to resources, education, and so on, and that leads to, you know, women dying, women not having the lifespans that they should have. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, economics doesn't, I mean, and actually you can go broader than that, of course, is that conventional economics doesn't measure, there are all sorts of things that it doesn't measure properly in GDP. So there's the unpaid work of women, but there are all sorts of environmental, of course, environmental factors that it doesn't properly measure in GDP. So, I mean, many economists now are critiquing GDP. It's certainly a pretty very rough measure of human welfare, if good at all. You know, it only captures certain things, and many things that we would consider really important to human welfare are not captured, including the kind of inequalities that you're mentioning there in terms of bias against women and so on. GDP doesn't kind of capture that stuff.
Well, there has been much discussed about Ireland's relationship with GDP, which we have talked about on the show, which I will deftly navigate away from, because of course the way in which it's calculated here can be different to many other places. The last thing I want to ask you is that over and over you challenge the assumptions, and this is why I was saying earlier there was a couple of cheeky chapters in it. You challenge the assumptions we have in economics. Three things: that people are rational, that people are only self-interested, and that people seek to absorb all the information around them. How damaging, Niall, is it to assume those three things?
Well, I guess that is the, in a way, that's the, those assumptions are kind of what go into your sort of textbook economics. So if you like, the economics that sort of developed from the late 19th century and created that sort of mathematical structure of economics. So it's the first thing that you sort of learn as a, you know, when you start studying economics. And, you know, increasingly economists are critiquing all that stuff and saying, you know, these are clearly you know, not very good descriptions of reality. How dangerous are they? Well, I guess one example of how dangerous that can be would be something like the financial crisis of the early 2007-2008, where in a sense it was assumed, you know, in the decades before that, yes, people are rational, they're absorbing all the correct kind of information, therefore financial markets are rational and efficient. And, you know, the efficient markets hypothesis is those ideas applied to the financial market, that they are pricing in information correctly and that the traders and speculators sort of know what they're doing. And of course, it was very, very far from that, wasn't it, when those banks collapsed. So in a sense, that was a very dramatic example of where those assumptions can be really dangerous.
Well, I will say, Niall, that as somebody who has a passion and an evolving knowledge of economics all the time, one of the books that I loved to read was Tim Harford's book called The 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. And it was a very accurate compliment he gave you on the back of the book here, when Tim Harford describes your book as a deft, readable history of economics full of humanity. You learn a lot. I did. And I think he really has it nailed in that. It's been a pleasure to have you here on Taking Stock. A genuine
lovely
pleasure.
Talking to you.
Thank you very much indeed. Niall Casheny, author of A Little History of Economics. Now, for the answer to my trivia question. I was in a city this week which was host to the Winter Olympics in 2010. Greenpeace was founded there in 1971, and it's home to the longest swimming pool in that respective country. And the length of that swimming pool is 137 metres. Where was I? And the answer to that question is Vancouver, British Columbia in Canada. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Faraday, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And I already look forward to chatting to you again next week.
Planning another business trip soon? When you fly Emirates, you can really make the most of your journey. Emirates offers a luxurious chauffeur-driven transfer from your door to and from the airport. You'll have access to the Emirates Lounge, where you can enjoy a drink, explore an international menu, or even take a shower. And on your flight, you can enjoy all the comforts of Emirates' world-class service. Get more from your business trips with Emirates. Book now on Emirates.com.